Yes, good evening.
Thank you for coming here on this very nice, lovely, wet and rainy evening. It's a pleasure. As we can see, there are 70 registered, but we can see how many have managed to come in this lovely weather. But it's nice. So that's Danish humor, isn't it? Such a nice, lovely weather, rainy, sun is shining, sorry, that should be the other way. Dansk ironie, they say. So I'm learning. That's good.
Swedish humor as well.
Also?
Yeah.
Okay, that's nice. Birgitta is from Sweden. So she lives in the center in Sweden, the Brahmakumari Center, and Sonia is traveling now for almost a month. So she's going to be here with us in the center, taking care of the center and taking care of us at the center as well. So welcome to her as well. So this month we have been looking at the self and society, how deep inner dynamics of the experience of self influence society as such through the behavior that we manifest. We have looked at aspects of freedom and responsibility. We've looked at aspects of inferiority and superiority that we did in the previous session. And we have been looking at it from the perspective of identity, personal identity, as well as social identity. And we have been looking at it from the perspective of how identity itself can manifest at a more unconscious level. It can be conscious, but it can also be a very unconscious process where I'm not aware really of the roots of my identity. So personal identity based in my own understanding of who I am, what I identify with when I call myself I. My abilities, qualities, my traits, etc. Social identity in terms of the groups, the social affiliations that I carry around with me, the baggage inside my head. Some I may acknowledge, some I may not acknowledge, but they influence my behavior. We've been looking at some of these issues. Today we will look at the issue of power and influence. So how do we understand power and how do we understand influence? What is your understanding of power and influence? Yes? Yes?
When you have got this, you are able to come through with what you want to do.
When we have got it, we can actually do something. We sort of, there is a will in it and we are able to accomplish something is what you're saying. Okay? Yes? From others.
Yeah.
So are you speaking about the power that we get from others?
Yeah.
In terms of support from them, in terms of strength. Yes. Is there a difference between the usage of these two words, power and strength, or is it really the same? Very often we use these as synonyms: power, strength, influence. We use these as synonyms. Power generally will, but you know, there could be subtle differences, but again, it depends on how you define these words, and you can define them in your own way. But generally speaking, when people speak about power in the social sciences, we are speaking more about the ability to influence others, the ability to exert an influence over others. And so, of course, very often when you speak about power, very often people have a negative reaction to power. They don't like the sound of the word power. They'd rather have some other word like strength. Okay, that makes more sense. That's more attractive. Power, because we see that people abuse power. People use power to manipulate, control, coerce, force people to do things. So influence over others can very often be seen in a very negative light because it is used in a negative way in the world. And so people have a resistance. From a spiritual perspective, when we speak about power as one of the main qualities of the soul. So we speak about purity, the fundamental quality of the soul in the philosophy of Raja Yoga. And we speak about love, peace, happiness, bliss, knowledge, but we also speak about power. And when you write the word power on the board, people react to it sometimes and say, no, but why power? Why can't we use another word? Yes, because people understand that this can be used in a very negative way. But then happiness can also be manifested in a negative way. So power is certainly an aspect of an ability to control and influence others' behavior, influence their thoughts, influence the way they go about doing things. So there is this outer expression of power or experience of power, where we are speaking about power over others. From a spiritual perspective, we also speak about the inner experience of power, that is, an influence over the self. This is probably closer to what you have spoken about. So one is the ability to influence the behavior of others, the other is the ability to influence our own behavior. The ability to influence the thinking, attitudes, feelings, and emotions of others, but also the ability to influence our own thoughts, feelings, emotions, and attitudes. So, do I have that influence over my thoughts, feelings, emotions, attitudes? Or do I again and again become a victim of my thoughts, feelings, emotions, attitudes, and behaviors? So this is the spiritual perspective of power. And then you have the other, more social perspective of power, that is power and influence over others. So is power and influence over others a bad thing? Shouldn't have it? What do you think? It's not a good thing? Sorry? If you use in a good way,
yeah.
It can be good.
Yeah. Mm. Except if you are a second class, if you power,
mm.
you use in a good way. It's very.
There you go. As a psychotherapist, you have power over the client because of your position of authority. As a parent, you have power over your children because of the position of your role. As a prime minister of a country, you have a power over the government and over the country itself because of the position that you're playing. So there is an aspect of power everywhere around us. And of course, power can be looked at in various ways. Normally speaking, when we look at power, we look at the exercise of very obvious ways of power, influencing others' behavior, making them do things in very obvious ways. But there can also be very subtle ways. Do you believe you all have power? Yes?
Yes.
Do you believe you have power over me?
Yes.
I don't believe you have power over me. Why do you think you have power over me? No? I'm asking you. I'll come back to you. Yes?
I don't mean I have power over you like as such.
Yeah?
Probably can influence you by the way I
probably can influence you. No, not convincing. What about you? Probably. No, not convincing. But you actually have power over me. I've come here for you. You've made me come here. Right? You have power over me. And I have power over you. In spite of all the rain and everything, I've made you come here, power over you. We exercise power. You are by coming here. You are actually controlling my behavior of coming here and speaking to you and preparing for a few hours before coming here and making a PowerPoint presentation for you. You are influencing my behavior and I'm influencing your behavior. We are influencing the behavior of the Danish government. They made this building for us. We have this room so that we can use it for such activities. The influence, the use of power is there all around. We cannot escape it. We all have power over each other. Whether we understand it, whether we consciously apply it or not is another story. But we all have power and influence over each other. It's a natural aspect of life. It's a natural aspect of social life. As such, it is neutral. Power in itself is neutral. A teacher has power over the students. The students have power over the teacher. Both are controlling each other's behavior, positively, negatively, it can work in any way. So power is there all around us. Power is there within us. We all exercise it. You exercise it over yourself. In spite of the rain and the dark weather, you exercised your power to actually come here. You got out of your blaze and you came in the rain. You were exercising power over yourself, and you were exercising power over me. And I was exercising power over you, as well as over myself. So power as such is, of course, a very natural aspect of life. Sometimes people differentiate between power and influence. Very often it is used, both the words are used as synonyms. But sometimes they say, power is the ability to influence, but influence is the way through which I am actually using power over others. But it doesn't matter. Generally speaking, we understand power over the self, power over others, and our ability to influence our own behavior, feelings, thoughts, attitudes, as well as others. So what are the various, what are the sources of power? How can we have power over others? How do we wield powers? Because we're looking at society. We're looking at the self in society. So let's look at that. How do we wield power over others? On what basis do we wield power over others? Do we wield power over others?
Relationship.
One is through, because of the virtue of the relationship. So the role that we play as a husband or a wife or a child or a parent or a teacher. So one way that we can, we wield power, we get power is through, by virtue of the role that we play. Children have, by the way, someone was telling me, a child is the most powerful. I asked why. I mean, you even look at, you know, very nice, very highly educated, extremely intellectual people, very mature. When they come in front of a child, they start, ooh. And the child controls it. The child has power over that behavior without doing anything. The child is just there. So even the child has power. Yeah? A dog has power, it can make you do so many things. And people spend millions and millions on a dog, more than they spend on themselves. So, okay, there is of course the aspect of role, the role that we play. What could be the other sources of power?
Money?
Yes, certainly, certainly. Wealth, money. That is also, of course, you have money, you have the power to influence your surroundings in many, many ways, positive as well as negative. That is, of course, a different story. Wealth, role, what else, how else can we use?
Jobs.
Sorry?
Jobs.
So the role that we play. It could be any role. It could be a role in an organization as an employee or as an employer. A wealth. Any other sources of the experiences?
Through the position that you may hold in society.
Yeah, so again, if we are looking at roles, we can also say position, make it more clear, status, similar things. It could be through a job. Yes?
That behavior as the same as role.
The behavior, the specific behaviors that we demonstrate is what you're speaking about?
Yes.
Yeah. So if you insult me, you might get me angry. You're exerting power over me. I actually have no power then, because you are controlling me.
Or if I look down all the time.
Yeah.
All of
you are looking down, or all of you are going to sleep. And obviously, again, you will influence me in some way, but I can be very powerful and not be influenced. I hope, but there could be, through behavior, verbal, non-verbal behaviors, by smiling at me, you will be influencing me, by not smiling at me, you will be influencing me. We influence each other through our behavior, both verbal as well as non-verbal behaviors, certainly. How else do we influence each other? How else do we have real power over each other? There can be even subtler manifestations of power. If you remember in the previous session and the session before that, we speak of this phenomenon of projective identification. Remember that? I project an image upon you, and then I make you behave like that to prove to myself that you are actually like that. Remember? We spoke about this. It happens in society a lot, especially with minority groups, foreigners, when they come into a country. So they are like that. There is a stereotype. They are like that. I look at them like that. My vision towards them is like that. My attitude towards them is like that. My behavior towards them is like that. And then I am in that way making them behave like that so that I can confirm my view that they are like that. Yeah, projective identification. And this comes from a very deep attitude that we are carrying towards people. We can also wield power over others through our attitude. The very belief that we carry about a person sometimes can make the person behave in that way, because our behavior towards that person is conditioned in that particular way. If you remember in the previous session, I've given you this example of the Pygmalion effect. They speak about it a lot in management. Pygmalion effect. Pygmalion coming from the king of Cyprus in Greek mythology, Pygmalion, who made a statue, fell in love with the statue, and then because he was pining for that statue to come to life, the statue came to life, Electra, and then he married her. So then, yeah, well, that's a story. But then the understanding is, and then I spoke to you about how there have been many experiments conducted where the Israeli army, for example, recruits join the army, and then you separated them into three groups, and the training chief was given information that group A has very high potential, group B, ordinary potential, group C, we don't know their potential. Actually, there was no difference between the three groups. After the training period, group A performed far, way beyond the other two groups, because of the attitude that I am carrying. So my attitude, my belief that they have that ability, they have those capabilities, my behavior towards them would be different, I would challenge them more, I would give them, you know, a lot of things. Through my attitude will reflect in my behaviors, verbal and non-verbal, and of course, they will rise to the challenge. Very interestingly, I conducted an experiment in the previous place where I was working. Yeah, the previous place that I was working, which was also a business school, I was teaching one course which was running in six groups. So there was big, about 300 students. There were six groups. And I was teaching all six groups. And so we have a midterm exam, and then we have an end-term exam. Okay. So at the midterm exam, I noticed that one of these groups was performing very, very low. It was the lowest. So when I took the exam aggregate marks, average marks, this particular section was the lowest in all the six groups. This was the lowest. All the others were in, you know, way beyond this section. There was, and then I said, okay, can I see statistically? And then I tried some statistical tests, and there was a statistical difference between this group and all the other groups in terms of performance. But I somehow believed that these guys can do much. I genuinely believed that. This was not manipulation. I genuinely believed that these guys can really do better. And then I thought, okay, you know, we speak about all these things in organizational behavior. Let's try it out. So I went back to class, and I verbally communicated that, not too much, now and then, inspiring them. You know, I've seen your results. So come on, you guys can do much better than this. You have. So giving them feedback on what they can actually accomplish, why I believe they can accomplish that, giving them proof that they have demonstrated that competence. A couple of times I did that, not too much, because then it becomes a bit too much. And I really wanted to see, and I could see behaviorally, I could see the changes in the class in terms of better quality of projects, better quality of assignments. And I wanted to see if that would really result in the overall performance, and the end-term results came, and it was amazing. I hadn't expected it. From number six, they went straight up to number one. All the other sections were in the same order, because I tried only with this section. All the other sections were in the same order. This section went straight up, right to the top. And again, there was a statistical difference between the other five sections and this section, only on the positive side this time. So this is again a teacher wielding power over the students, but then how am I using that power? And very interestingly, that same section, I was still, you know, we used to have this tea meeting every day with our colleagues at around 11 o'clock. So everybody would come and they would badmouth that section. Oh, this section, it's useless. These guys, they don't know. Oh, it's always cribbing about that same section. And I thought, no, but. And see, that's again my attitude. And then, obviously, if my attitude towards the students is like that, they are going to perform like that. Self-fulfilling prophecy. My attitude will control their behavior. And then, I proved to myself, I knew they were useless. But see, my attitude has actually made them useless. And if I transform my attitude, I can actually make them perform better than they would have otherwise performed. But of course, this has to be grounded in reality. It cannot be a fantasy, yes.
What did your colleagues
say? Well, I showed them the results. They were quite, well, you know, many of them, number crunching people, business school, accounting and finance, they're very, very skeptical. Then I demonstrated the results statistically. They said, okay, but they were still skeptical. But I'm working on a paper around that now. But anyway, that's besides the point. The point is we can wield a lot of power, and we do wield a lot of power, whether we know it or not, even through our attitude. And so we can have many, many very subtle, from very subtle to very gross sources of power over others. Yes? No, it's not that they don't want. Then there could be other defense mechanisms.
Yeah.
One is, for example, that's, you know, proving to them that they were wrong, which also makes them feel guilty. So, but anyway, that's besides the point. Let's not get into that. But the point here is the power of attitude. And so it's very subtle, but it is, of course, very, very potent. And we can use it. You know, when you meditate for a period of time, you can actually feel it. You can feel the power of the other's attitude influencing you negatively as well as positively. And sometimes you can sense it, because you tend to become quite sensitive to such things. And then again, how do I let the other's negative attitude influence me? Again, that's a question of my power. How much of resistance do I have towards that? So I don't give in to playing the role that the other wants me to play. The other wants me to play the role of a victim. The other wants me to play the role of a particular stereotype. Say, a person wants me to play the role of the stereotypical foreigner, clumsy, not knowing what to do, maybe a little not well suited and adjusted, and not very good manners in terms of the local culture. Because identity dynamics are coming in here. When identity dynamics come in, and I associate myself with the identity of being an Indian, and I see a foreigner coming into my country, and I associate that person to be, say, for example, an American, and in my mind I have a stereotype of Americans are like this. And so, in my mind there is a certainty associated with that stereotype. That certainty gives me a sense of security. I am like this and you are like that. And I want to maintain that. To maintain that security, I will communicate to the other foreigner, oh, you are like that, you are like that. I may not do it verbally, but I do it again and again and again. The person ends up behaving like that. So I can prove to myself that, yeah, see, that person is like that and I am like this and I hold on to my security. Deep dynamics working inside me. And I may not be aware of it. But it happens very, very frequently. Very, very frequently. I've seen it very, very clearly. And it happens in all countries. I've seen it in India when foreigners come. The people have a stereotype. Oh, these guys are like this. Someone's come from Africa. Oh, these guys are like this. Americans are like this. The English are like this. The Japanese are like that. And so very clear categories. And then I'm communicating that. They end up behaving like that. If they end up behaving like that, it validates to me my identity. And I hold on to it. So like that, our attitudes, our beliefs can wield immense power over others. And of course, we are always influencing the world around us through our attitudes and our beliefs. So power can, of course, people speak about power as manifesting along a continuum. It can manifest in various ways. For example, it can manifest on this side through coercion, that is the use of power as force, intimidation, threat. Here I am using power in its most crass form that I can possibly use. Force, intimidation, threat. Again, is force, the use of force to make people behave in a certain way, is that necessarily wrong? Is that necessarily wrong? Look at the government. If the government did not have systems, say traffic rules in place, or rules of tax in place, which forces people to behave in a certain way, because if they break it, then there is a huge fine associated with it. If you remove all these laws from the world and say, oh, force is bad, let's not use force, will it work? But very often, the moment we hear of force We say, oh, no, not good, but then that is how the world is. It would be very difficult for the world. Of course, in an ideal world, everybody would follow the rules without any laws. That's the golden age. When we drive you, when you speak about the golden age, you speak about that world. That world where power is so deeply entrenched internally that people are guided by their own inner morality. And therefore, there is no need for external rules and regulations to control behavior. But until we reach that stage, we would probably need it, right? If we didn't have the rules of tax in Denmark the way they are, would we pay 45% minimum tax? It would be very difficult to imagine that. Some would, some might, many would perhaps, but of course there would also be many who wouldn't. Even now when they have to, they find ways of going around it. So if it wasn't there, we can imagine what would happen. So yes, force, threat, it sounds very negative, but sometimes it can be quite necessary in society. So this could be one experience, expression of power. Moving towards the softer side, we can have something on the lines of persuasion, where I convince people, I use logic, I use argument to make people behave the way I would like them to behave. Right? This is persuasion. So where I do not use coercion, of course I have the option of using persuasion. Persuasion is of course something very, you know, like a teacher would use with the students to win them over to his point of view. Students will use against the teacher, the arguments, the debates that we have in society, persuasive. The kind of leadership very often we speak about as persuasive leadership. For example, Gandhi was a good example of persuasive leadership. He did not really have any formal authority. Gandhi, the one who fought for, you know Gandhi, right? Indian independence, yes. So, a good example of that. Nelson Mandela is another good example of that. They did not really have any formal authority. The authority that they developed was through their ability to actually persuade people, using arguments in a very focused, logical, coherent manner so that people actually get converted to their point of view. And so through that, they're able to make people do what they would like them to do. But again, it can be used positively, it can also be used negatively. Hitler also used persuasion, along with coercion, but also persuasion. So you also have various people using persuasion for negative ends and for positive ends. Again, you can have it manifested in both ways. So in itself, it's neutral. However, from a spiritual perspective, but also from a more subtle perspective, can we go further towards a softer side and more subtle side? And if we go further, then we look at the power manifested through sheer presence. The very presence, the very existence in a situation can wield power. For example, your presence here, physical presence. But that physical presence itself wields power, has influence over me. You're not persuading me. You're not coercing me. Your presence itself wields power over me. So one way of looking at presence is, of course, the physical existence of an entity in a situation that controls the situation. But presence can also be a lot more subtle than just physical existence. So we can look at presence as, of course, behaviors of existence, that of being present, existent, as we spoke about it. But of course, it could be more subtle in terms of the attitudes that we carry with us in our presence. It can be even more subtle in our silence. We often speak about the power of silence. From a spiritual perspective, of course, when we speak about the power of silence, we are speaking about something else. But even if you don't look at it from a spiritual perspective, silence has its own impact. Right? We know that. We can control people through silence. Someone is asking you lots of questions, just be quiet and don't respond. See what happens to the other person. You can control people through the silence. But that's a very gross way of looking at silence. From a spiritual perspective, we look at silence in a slightly different way. And we will look at that again. So again, through presence again, we can influence people positively, we can influence people negatively. Again, that in itself is neutral. So power as such, as we understand it, can be used it can also be abused. So we speak about the use of power, and we speak about the abuse of power. What determines the use or abuse? Whichever form of power you take, be it coercive power, I can use it positively to govern people, to ensure that society functions in a decent way. Because without that, it would be very difficult sometimes to control society, control the world around us. Even when we look at the self, sometimes if I don't use a certain discipline over myself, I can easily slip back into old patterns of self-defeating behavior. Sometimes I also need to use some element of force on myself to make myself do things that are good for me. Otherwise, I would end up not doing them. Look at persuasion, again, using it over others. I can persuade people to do all sorts of things, from the very positive to the very negative. I can persuade myself to do all sorts of things, from the very positive to the very negative. Persuasion can be very, very subtle, like, for example, the kind of persuasion we use in advertisements. So a celebrity who has nothing whatsoever to do with the product endorses a product. We get a message, we are persuaded to buy the product because of the association with the celebrity. The celebrity has not talked about it so much, there has not been any verbal thing happening there, no verbal persuasion, but the association itself in the mind has a power over us. So persuasion, coercion can also be very, very indirect. One is very direct. I know the rules. You break this rule, you have a consequence, and therefore follow this behavior. Very, very clear. That is very direct use of coercion and force. Coercion can also be very, very subtle. Where? I ensure that you get to know that if you don't, no rules are written. But if you don't behave in this way, if you don't follow these values, if you don't follow these attitudes, you don't dress up in this particular way, then you're out. You're not included in this society. So there is nothing said, no, we don't say it because obviously it's not politically right to say it. But we carry these things within us. And so through an indirect way, we are enforcing others to behave in a certain way. So it can, force can also be very, very indirectly used. Persuasion, as we mentioned before, can also be very direct as an argument and logic and convincing people, but in very subtle ways, where I give a message to people that if you want to be worthy, if you want to be recognized, buy this product, for example. Many of us may not fall to that, but many people do, and that's why celebrity endorsements work so well. Presence is, of course, a very subtle process, but it can be physically experienced and manifested in terms of behavior. It can also be very, 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 very subtle at the level of thoughts. So from a spiritual perspective, we understand that through the quality of the thoughts we generate, we are influencing others. Because thoughts don't stay limited to this physical body, they're non-physical. So when I'm generating thoughts about another person, those thoughts are reaching out and reaching that person. And through the power of my thoughts, I'm influencing that person to behave in a certain way. Have you ever experienced this? I don't know. Have you ever experienced this? Where you haven't spoken to anyone, but your attitude towards them has become negative. It wasn't before, it has now, because of whatever may have happened. You haven't told them anything, you haven't said anything, but your attitude towards them has become negative. Your mind is full of negative thoughts towards that person, and that person's attitude towards you changes. Have you experienced it? You have? Have you? No? Not that you're aware of. You have? Anyone else? You have? You have? Quite a few people have? Quite a few people have. Have you ever experienced that your attitude towards someone is negative and that person's behavior towards you is negative, but you work on yourself, you transform your attitude, you start feeling, actually feeling love for that soul, and that person's behavior towards you has changed? Have you experienced it anymore? You have. Many have. So through that, again, there is a great power in our thoughts, and that we can use. We can use it negatively, we can use it positively. That's really up to us. But the question is about recognizing that I have this power. If I'm generating negative thoughts, I am wielding my power. knowing it, unknowingly, knowingly, but I am doing it. If I'm using it positively, I'm wielding my power. The choice is mine. So, that's also an abuse of power. Is it not? I have the power of thoughts, and I'm directing a lot of negative thoughts towards someone. I'm abusing my power. And firstly, I'm abusing my power towards myself because it goes against the values of the soul, and therefore I'm creating trauma for the soul. And because I create trauma for the soul, I lose control over the self. So then I become weak. So, but how do we differentiate between the use of power and the abuse of power? Well, yes, go.
I'd say it has to do with the harmony in which it's used, if you use it to benefit both parties.
Mm.
If it's use of power, only one of the parties, usually yourself.
Limited, yeah. It could be the self, or it could be my family, my country, my, you know, whatever. It could be any limited identity. So, of course, as you mentioned, when we speak about the use of power, we are looking at a more ecocentric perspective. Ecocentric. Ecology. Looking at our environment. I'm a part of that environment, so when I say the environment, I am a part of it. I can't exclude myself from that. I'm naturally a part of it. So when we're looking at an ecocentric perspective, we're looking at a perspective that is beneficial for me and the environment around me. And by the environment around me, I don't mean necessarily a limited environment. It could be, depending on circumstances. So my country, my people, my community. Fine, we can do that. But the moment my community, my country, my nation becomes exclusive, then it's our national interest. If you look at the news these days, or for many years now, why these days? Everybody speaks about national interest. What about the interests of the others? No, national interests. But of course, if I don't speak about national interests, no one's going to elect me. Why would people vote for me? Everybody is bothered about their interests. So when I speak about national interests, then I am speaking to the people who are there in that country who are looking after their interests. So fine, I get elected. But at the end of the day, the world as such doesn't really benefit because everybody wants to take care of their national interests. And so others who do not facilitate their national interests can be dispensed with. They can be killed. They can be exploited, they can be manipulated, that's okay, it doesn't matter, because I will take care of my national interests. And this is where we come to the other aspect of power, that is the egocentric, centered on the ego, centered on what we speak about as the ego identity. And of course, this ego identity can be personal. It can also be social. So in terms of personal, I'm looking at I, me, myself, what is beneficial for me? How can I derive the best out of the situation? What's in the situation for me? I'm looking at that, that's it, and I'm bothered about that. My own interest. So validating my competencies, proving to myself that I am good, proving to myself that I am kind and generous. So I can be very kind and generous, but to prove to myself that I am kind and generous, it's a very egocentric attitude. So I'm using my power, but in a very egocentric way. And therefore, I'm limiting myself. So in my kindness and generosity, there is my self-validation. And because of my self-validation, I am focused on myself. And because I'm focused on myself, others are only tools which can be manipulated in order to make me feel good about myself. So I'm using my power there. But it's basically directed at the self. Social identity. I identify myself with my religious group, with my political party, with my organization, with my country. And therefore, I will do things in the larger interests. But those larger interests are limited to that particular boundary that I have created for myself. So I will do things for the benefit of my religion. So we have benefit and you don't have benefit. I will do things for my country so we get benefit and you, okay, that's up to you, but you know, we will take care of our interests. And in this way, in society, we create a world of divisions. So we take care of our interests. We don't take care of the other's interests. The others get angry, then they want to take care of their interests. They don't take care of our interests, then we get angry. And so we keep feeding each other's anger, each other's pain, and we end up in a world of conflict. But coming fundamentally from the egocentric identity that I have created for myself, and therefore from a spiritual perspective, it is so very imperative for us to go beyond our ego identity. There is really, I mean, as far as I look at, there is no other option. What other option is there? In this world today, we can no longer, if you're looking at a beautiful future of the world, I can't afford to be Hindu, Muslim, Christian, Buddhist. I can't afford to be that. I can't afford to stick and imprison my identity within that. If I want this world to be peaceful and good and happy in the future, I can't afford to be Danish, sorry. I can't afford to be Indian. I can't afford to be American. I can't. Because the moment I restrict my identity to that, I am excluding others. And the moment I exclude others, I will engage in some discriminatory behavior. It may not be very obvious, but it is there. It's very subtle in the mind. The example of the student of mine from Sri Lanka that I had mentioned, I don't know if you remember it. Very nice guy, going out, helping others. You hear the news. The fighting in Sri Lanka between Tamils and the Sinhalese. The moment you would hear someone has died, who has died? Sinhalese? Oh, Tamils? Ah, okay. Not that he went around killing anyone. No, he didn't do that. He didn't want to do that. But the roots of identity are so deep. Automatic. The reaction is automatic. Oh, my people are safe. Okay. Who has died? Oh, they have died. Okay, no, not so bad. Not so good, but okay. See, in a very subtle way, it's okay. They can die. My people cannot die. Very subtle. And very often, we are not aware of it. And therefore, when we look at identity, be it ecocentric, be it egocentric, very often it can be quite unconscious. And when we know the unconscious has immense power over us, if we are not aware of it, that's going to control us and I become a victim. If I'm aware of that, I can control it and therefore I can transform it. And therefore, when we speak about understanding how identity is working, I need to make the unconscious aware. So, this is the aspect of the ego identity, the egocentric identity, of course, when we speak about it from the perspective of spirituality. We are speaking about a spiritual awareness. The awareness of being souls, the awareness of being children of God, the awareness that we are actually fundamentally one, and not just the intellectual knowledge of this, no, that doesn't help. That doesn't help. We all speak about it. Everywhere in the world people speak about it. Oh, we're all equal, we're all the same. Do we really believe it? If you don't believe it, why should we even say it? First, let me believe it. Otherwise, it's just talk, right? But somehow the soul recognizes the truth. The soul recognizes that we are really equal. That truth is there, buried in the deep, unconscious experience of the soul. It's there, but I don't feel it. But because it's there, I say it, but I don't really feel it. See, the world is full of examples of how desperately humanity has tried to prevent war. Full of examples, right? We had the First World War. After that, people in the Western world. In the Eastern world, you had many other things happening. In the Western world, you had the First World War. We are sitting here. After that, people, the powerful nations of the world, the ones that have influence, they come together and they say, we cannot have another war. And so they form the League of Nations. Failed. Second World War. Worse destruction. Now the Second World War, everybody comes together and says, we cannot afford to have another world. Form the United Nations. Fail again. We've had so many wars since that. We continue to have wars in the world. Humanity is trying. Humanity is sincerely, desperately trying. But then, because we are stuck here, and we are not fully aware of the implications of that. We are not fully aware of the consequences of being stuck in our own ego. My national identity, my regional identity, my religious identity. We are not fully aware. We don't fully recognize the deep impact it has on myself and on the world. We keep following it. We keep becoming the victims of the compulsion to protect and to prove. Protect, prove, protect, prove. Protect my ego, prove my ego. Protect my ego, prove my ego. Be it personal, be it social. It's all the same. It eventually ends up. So therefore, when we speak about moving to a spiritual awareness, it's not talk. It's about real deep work on the self. Real deep work on the self. So what do we do? What do we need, first of all, to make this shift? To make this shift? Yes?
Desperation.
Desperation. Is that enough?
It could be a start.
It could be a start. But what else do I need? You know, the world is full of people who are desperate. Yeah, let's do something. But what? I don't know. Let's just do something. They say, ranting and raving, rebel without a cause. Let's be rebellious. For what? Let's be rebellious. So yes, it gives us a lot of energy, that desperation. What do we need to transform that into something sensible?
Knowledge.
I need understanding, right? I need a fundamental awareness, understanding, whatever I want to call it. Of course, knowledge itself may not be enough, but that is where we begin. The knowledge of the difference between this and this. The knowledge, and by knowledge, we don't mean information. In the Hindi, there's a very nice word for knowledge. The word is gyan. And gyan means a lot more than just information of something. Gyan is, there are two roots to it. One is to recognize something, and the other is to recognize and to know, as in to hold it within you. To hold it within you. And that is knowledge. And that is very often spoken about as enlightened knowledge. Today I've made a little PowerPoint presentation for you. And in that, we will try and look at how has knowledge been represented, because we understand, deep inside, the soul recognizes the importance of knowledge, the importance of true knowledge, the importance of the deep spiritual understanding of the implications of being egocentric, the implications of being egocentric. And when I wield that knowledge becomes a source of great strength. Very often, people speak about knowledge is might. Knowledge is power. Knowledge is might. Yeah. When will knowledge be might? When will knowledge be might? From a spiritual perspective, when we speak about knowledge, we say knowledge will be might when I can hold it. That is, I wield it. And this experience, this deep experience of holding knowledge, wielding knowledge, and exerting power through knowledge, we can see this reflected in many mythological symbols. For example, there is a symbol in Norse mythology. Holding knowledge, wielding knowledge, and the power that it gives you. What is that symbol? This is going back to our very first session that we had in this autumn. The unconscious, the dynamics of the unconscious. So we have the personal unconscious and we have the collective unconscious. And we speak about how common experiences of humanity are expressed through the collective unconscious. Because I cannot really experience them clearly, they are expressed, they get projected into the world outside in symbols and myths and stories and legends. In Norse mythology, you have a symbol, knowledge as might. You hold and you wield and you exercise power. There is a statue on the top of Carlsberg building in Bellevue. Have you ever seen that statue? You haven't seen it. I've seen it. Have a day. Right. I've seen it. The statue on the top, you can't see it. You know the elephants?
Yeah.
You can see the elephants because they're right in front of you. The statue on the top of the building. On the top of the building, so you can't see it. You have to look up like this. Now there's something there. And then you go back and say, oh, there's something there. Very funny. It's on the top of the building. You know what's that statue? Yeah, it is Thor. Thor's hammer, Mjolnir. It has a very interesting shape, the hammer. But again, the way we look at it, the symbol of power, of course, shown here as Thor killing the Jotun, the giants. But then, of course, that is, you know, the exercise of influence, of power over the world, but primarily over the self. And the symbol of the hammer. You can crush, you can break things completely with a hammer. You cannot do that with a spear or an arrow, but the hammer. That is the immense power that we have, that knowledge can provide us in transforming the self. And through that, transforming the world. The hammer of Thor, Mjolnir. And you find the same symbol in many places. By the way, it's not unique only to Norse mythology. For example, in Indian mythology, you have a very similar symbol, Hanuman, the monkey god. And again, you have this mace. He's always shown with the mace, a symbol of strength. So, and again, they're holding it in their hands. They never let go of it. Thor, when he uses his hammer, it comes back to him. It always comes back to him. You know the legend of Mjolnir, right? It'll never go far away. It will always be close to the person who owns it. So he throws it, it comes back to him. He throws it, it comes back to him. And he's always holding it. Spiritually, we understand it as holding knowledge in our consciousness. It's not about holding it in the hand, but the hand of the intellect, the hand of the soul. I hold knowledge in my awareness. And when I hold knowledge in my awareness, it gives me power. If I don't hold it, it doesn't give me power. It's just lying somewhere in some locker, locked up. It doesn't really matter. So what is holding knowledge? So for example, first knowledge of Raja Yoga. I am a soul. Very simple. I am a soul. Do we still feel fear? You all heard about this, right? We meditate, I am a soul, point of light, oh, shining, sparkling star. We all do this, right? You still feel fear? Do you still feel fear sometimes in your life?
Yes.
Yeah. Why does fear come? The soul is eternal. It cannot be killed. It cannot be destroyed. Nothing can really finish the soul. The soul is energy. And if I am that soul, why should I be afraid? I'm driving on the streets. Someone cuts me. Why do I react?
Insecurity.
Therefore, this ego identity is based on insecurity. But that insecurity is coming because I have let go of the awareness of being a soul. If I am a soul, nothing can destroy me. Nothing. No fire can burn me. No accident can kill me. No ocean can drown me. I am eternal. I am immortal. See the power in that. If I hold it in my awareness, if I hold it, nothing can shake it. If I am shaking, I have let go of it. So one is understanding something intellectually. The other is holding it in my consciousness. And when I hold it, I have power. I'm feeling anger. Where does anger come from? Knowledge. Where does anger come from?
Insecurity.
It comes from insecurity. It comes from fear. It comes from pain. And here we go into the other experience of knowledge. Knowledge is might. And they often speak about knowledge as light. Knowledge is might. Knowledge is light because knowledge, true knowledge, enlightens the soul. So I am feeling anger and I am giving in to the anger. I am cursing the other, I am directing my anger at the others, or I am directing it at myself because I am frustrated. I have not been able to achieve all those things I wanted to achieve in life. Where is that desire to achieve all these things in life coming from? It's coming from my emptiness. It's coming from my incompleteness. I want to fill it up by achieving my faith. That will never fill me up. And I want to do it and I get frustrated. It is coming because the motivation itself is based on falsehood. And the falsehood here being, I want to fill my emptiness by accomplishing things in the world. I understand this. I get enlightened. Knowledge is light. And therefore, when I use knowledge as light and I hold that light in my intellect, knowledge becomes might. It becomes power. I get control. And the moment I recognize, oh, my anger is emerging from my own pain. Why am I angry at you? Because I'm angry at you. Because you said something bad to me. You didn't smile at me. You didn't speak to me well. Why? Why is your behavior affecting me? So your behavior is influencing me. Power. In a negative way. Why is that affecting me? Because I expect from you. Because I love you. Otherwise, you will never get upset with people. Especially close relationships. I love you. I want you to love me. It's not enough that I love you. I want you to love me. And so I have now gone here to egocentric. Am I want you to love me. So in my what's my belief? How will I know that you love me? You smile at me, you look kind at me, you don't scold me. You scold me, you're unkind to me, you don't love me. I get angry at you. But if I don't understand the whole process, I don't have control over my anger. The moment I understand the process, I know my anger is coming because of my egocentrism. It's not coming because of love. It's coming because of my selfishness. I want you to make me feel good. The root of that is love. But that love is mixed with attachments and expectations. Knowledge is light. Provided I use it, then knowledge is light. And the moment I understand that, I can control my anger. Because I am in control, not you. It's not your behavior that has influenced me. It is my expectations from you that has influenced me. And this is something I can control. This is something I can transform. But how will I transform it? I want love. If you don't give me love, who will give me love? But there is God. If I turn to Him, I can experience love. I can experience love much more than you can ever give me. Knowledge is light. And so when I use it in that way, yes.
I'm thinking, you know, all the time when you're speaking about knowledge is light, I'm thinking, how do you define wisdom?
Yes, these are also words that we use as synonyms sometimes, knowledge and wisdom. We use them as synonyms, but there could be a difference. Some people say wisdom is like the application of knowledge.
Isn't it like wisdom is placed more in the heart, knowledge is placed more in the
heart? Oh, I think that would really depend on how we define knowledge and wisdom.
Yeah.
And we can define it in different ways.
Okay.
But the way I look at it, at least, wisdom is more like the application of knowledge. So I'm being wise, I'm applying understanding in a proper way. But knowledge is the basic understanding. I need to have that understanding. Without that, I don't have that power. So, and then again, symbolically, in mythology, we see the expression of knowledge as light. And how that light can give us power. Any, yes?
So how can you define light? More like enlightenment or light?
When I hold light, when I use knowledge as light, I'm being enlightened, right? And when I'm enlightened, that gives
me. So light is more like hope?
Yeah, but with a deep understanding. Because if, for example, I sit in meditation and I keep telling, I focus. What do I focus on? I imagine a point shining in the center of the brain. Sorry, that's not yoga. That's not yoga. That will make you feel good. Because the mind is so disturbed, I become a little silent. You focus on a candlelight for some time. You feel good. Because all the distracting thoughts have gone away. So concentration that way can give us a temporary experience of peace. But when we speak about knowledge, it's not just about focus, it's about deep understanding. Actually, in Raja Yoga, if you look at it, there is really no process of visualization. We use it, it can support the process, but meditation itself is not visualization. Meditation is becoming an embodiment of knowledge. It is repeating knowledge into yourself, making knowledge sink deeper and deeper into the intellect. And so you can't see the soul. The soul is not physical. There's nothing to see. Turn my eyes inwards and see the soul, I get a headache. There's nothing to see. It's the understanding. I am a soul. And in the process of yoga, it's going deeper into this understanding. So when you speak about focus, yes, focus, but focus with understanding, understanding that leads to an experience. So the chance that we have to sit in meditation, we could use it constructively by allowing ourselves to go into the experience of being a soul. What does it mean to be a soul? It means I am indivisible, indestructible, eternal. What does it mean to be a soul? It means to be a being of love and peace and happiness and power and purity. What does it mean to be a soul? It means to be a child of God. That means He is always available for me. What does it mean to be a soul? It means the whole world is my family. Black, brown, white, yellow, all my family. Because the soul is not black, white, yellow, brown. The soul is light. It's my family. What does it mean to be a soul? Going into the depths of that. That is Rajyoga. And that is knowledge as light. And in mythology, again, we have plenty of symbols of knowledge as light. For example, Zeus with a thunderbolt. Thunderbolt, light. And you use it as a weapon to overcome evil. And the thunderbolt always stays with Zeus. He sends it out, it comes back to him. Very much like Thor's hammer, by the way. Thor's hammer. And both are supposed to be the gods of thunder and rain, as such, governing. Again, if you go back to Eastern mythology, you have Indra, the god Indra. Very similar to Zeus and Thor. Again, the weapon is the thunderbolt. He's the god of the clouds and the rain and the storm and the wind. The thunder and lightning, basically. And so it's called Vajra. It's a different weapon he has, but through that he can release a thunderbolt. And one of the legends is that there were two evil giants. One of them removed all light from the world, so the world was in darkness. The other one removed all moisture from the world, so everything started, you know, drying up, basically. There was no life left in this world. And so, someone made this Vajra weapon for him, and through this weapon, he kills these demons, these evil characters. And through that, the light comes back into the world, water and moisture comes back into the world becomes green again, there is sunshine. So basically, again, the whole symbolic of conquering evil, but through the use of knowledge, enlightened knowledge, and that's where knowledge becomes power. And so, for knowledge to actually be, and of course, when we speak about light, very often, the eyes are associated with light, because it is through the eyes that you can see light. To use knowledge as might, I need to use it as light. To use it as light, I need insight. I need a very deep spiritual insight. And we also have symbols in mythology that speak about knowledge as sight, knowledge as divine insight. When I have the divine insight, first I need the insight. Then I hold the insight, it is experienced as light. That light gives me strength and power, that is might. And this is the symbol of Odin. Some of you were, I think, there at one of the talks that we spoke about Odin, another symbol from Norse mythology. Odin is shown with one eye. He had two eyes before, but now he's got just one eye. And how did he get that one eye? Because he had heard that there is a well of wisdom. The well of wisdom, which is deep under the roots of Yggdrasil. Yggdrasil is the tree of the universe in Norse mythology. You may know about that. It has three roots. Under one of those roots is a well. And the patron of the well is Mimir. Mimir guards the well. And that's the well of wisdom. So Odin wants to go and drink from the well of wisdom. But the condition is, if he wants to drink from the well of wisdom, he has to give one of his eyes as a pledge. Only then he is allowed to drink from the well of wisdom. But Odin wants to be wise, so he gives his eye, and then in return he gets to drink from the well. And of course, as you know, he's the king of all the gods in Norse mythology, the ruler of Asgard, power, the king, achieved through knowledge, divine insight, one eye, the symbolism of giving away one eye, and then you're looking only through one eye. As we understand it spiritually, that's the understanding of removing all duality. Plurality. There is oneness. There is no oneness in the world. We know we are different. We are different. We will always be different, but it doesn't matter. Because then I'm not looking at the differences. I'm looking at the oneness. While seeing the differences, while respecting the differences, I'm looking at oneness. That is a spiritual knowledge. We are one because we are all soul, spiritual beings, children of God. Holding that in my mind, that insight, that deep insight, and I use it as light, I experience might. So a lot about using the knowledge of spirituality and holding it in our intellect, which then, of course, gives us power. But first, I need the power of discernment. I need the insight of what is what. What is egocentric? What is egocentric? Am I fooling myself that I am being egocentric, where in reality I am being egocentric? It can happen very easily. I mean, I'm doing everything for others, but I'm actually doing it to feed my own ego. It can happen very, very easily. No? I can say, oh, I'm doing voluntary work, I'm coming every Sunday, I'm speaking to all people, oh, see, I'm being so nice. The moment I slip into that kind of reasoning, I'm shifting from egocentric to egocentric. And then I'm just fooling myself, I'm deceiving myself. If I'm truly egocentric, I won't even think about that. That will be a very natural manifestation of my existence, my being. And it's very, and very, we all have these motives, let's recognize that. We have both the motives. So that's not such a great, deep, dark secret. But the trick is to recognize when I'm slipping to the other side and bring myself back. When I'm slipping, bring myself back, using knowledge, using insight to understand the difference, using knowledge as light to bring myself back, using knowledge as might to hold what is right in my intellect. And then when I do that, I find transformation and I find real power. Power where I exert influence over others in a very positive, constructive way. And I do not allow the negative influence of others to influence me. Then we all want that, right? To use in knowledge. But for that, it's good to hear knowledge every day. Now, once a while we hear it, we forget it. 90 minutes we sit and we talk about it. In about 90 minutes we can forget it. And that is why in the center we have this practice of meeting every day. Because you need to meet every day. You need to meet, sit and talk with like-minded people about such things. Otherwise it's so easy. All the concerns and the problems and challenges of the world can very easily make us shift from our spiritual state inside. Very easily. It's so easy. I need that gathering, I need that atmosphere, practicing it, speaking about it. So the more I speak about it, the more I hear spiritual things, the more I can hold it in my intellect because it's available in my brain. And the more I hold it, the more powerful I can become. The more powerful I become, the more control and influence I have over my own behavior, thoughts, feelings, attitudes, as well as over the behaviors of others in a very constructive way. Okay, thank you very much. Any thoughts, questions? No? So let us conclude with some practice of meditation.
Would this lecture also be in the internet? Because you don't have
the... Yes, but I have recorded it on the laptop. I hope it has recorded well. If it has recorded, it will be available to you. But as you know, this is our last talk for the autumn. And now we take a little break for Christmas and New Year. And I think we will be able to start the spring talks only in March, not before March. But those of you who are on the mailing list will get to know anyway. And those of you who would like to know, please sign up for the mailing list. You have some forms there. Or you can just send an email to the center saying you want to be on the mailing list and you will get to know when the talks are organized. But meanwhile, you know the center is there at your disposal. You know, many of you know, some may not know, we have meditation every day in the evenings for everyone, 6 to 6.30. Also have a little talk after that. And we have meditation every day in the morning. So you're welcome to come. You have the schedule of the center on the internet. So it's good if you keep in touch. So you can hold the knowledge in your intellect and use it as light and might and become very, very powerful, which you are in any case. Thank you very much. Let's have a little meditation. Would you like some music also? Or shall we do it in silence? Silence is good. Yes, let's do that. Let's do that.
some thoughts for you to contemplate when you sit in meditation, for example. Raj Yoga meditation is based on knowledge. It is a knowledge-based system of practice. It's not a system of practice that is based on concentration, focusing. These come later. It is a system that is based on knowledge. The logic being knowledge, true knowledge, spiritual knowledge, takes us into silence. In silence, we can connect with ourselves as souls. In the awareness of being souls, spiritual beings, we can connect with God. And in that connection, the soul begins to heal and therefore start experiencing its inner strength and power. If I am unable to experience silence, that means I am not wielding knowledge. Very simple rule. So if I sit in meditation and my mind is getting distracted, going here, there, here, there, here, there, let me understand, I am not using knowledge to go into silence. I am forcing the mind to go into silence. It will not work that way. So then I can shift to knowledge, bring spiritual knowledge into my awareness. Who am I? Four questions, remember this. First question, who am I? I am a soul. Am I this body? Am I my identity? Am I my culture, my religion, my name, my family? No. I am a soul. And all the thoughts that distract the mind are related to all these things. My family, my work, my country, my religion, my money, my income. That's not me. First step. If I have not climbed the first step, it's very difficult to go beyond. And therefore, if I am getting distracted, the likelihood is that I have not climbed the first step of yoga. Then I sit for half an hour, I struggle with my mind, I force it to be silent, then I get frustrated because it's not happening. Because I have not used the right method. I have not climbed the first step. I have tried to jump straight to the top. Doesn't work. Climb the first step. Who am I? First knowledge. Who am I? I am not my name. I am not my religion. I am not my culture. I am not my work. I am not my family. I am not my activities. I am not my responsibilities. I am not my achievements. I am not my possessions. I am not any of those things. Who I am is the eternal soul. You become silent, don't you? Second step, where have I come from? I come from the world beyond. I come from that world of silence. I come from that invisible dimension. I come from the soul world. And I see myself in that soul world. Invisible dimension, beyond space, beyond time, beyond matter. I come from that world of deep, silent peace. Third question. Who do I belong to? Eternally, who do I belong to? In this life, in this body, I may belong to my family, my relationships, everything. Who do I belong to as a soul? I belong to God. And I belong to the whole world. I belong to humanity. All souls in the world are my family. Fourth question. Who are these other souls? Who is this God? He is a being of light. All other souls are beings of light. We are one family. And then I stay in that awareness of being a soul. Connected to God. a sparkling star. Separate from this world. Lost in that world of light. Resting in the presence of the Supreme. Resting under the light of God. Allowing the light of the Supreme to flow into me. Healing, purifying. Filling the soul with deep spiritual strength. And in this awareness of being the soul, an immortal, eternal being of light, in the presence of the Supreme Light, I experience the deep power of silence. Holding on to this deep silence and this deep power, I return to my role that I play through the physical costume of this body. Seated as a soul, the eternal light, in the center of the brain, looking out through the windows of these eyes, listening through these ears, the tiny spark of infinity. A being of light. A being of peace. Om Shanti. So thank you very much. And go Aften or go Yule or go Newtor, as they say. Or God Newtor. See you when we see you.
Yes.
Have a very powerful winter.